Good afternoon. We are ready to proceed with Corcoran versus Bush. Mr. Martin.
Good afternoon. Your Honors, I've reserved 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
That'll be fine.
May it please the Court. The District Court erroneously granted habeas relief in this case because it did so without clearly established federal authority to support its opinion. Specifically, this is in regard to Mr. Corcoran's contention that pretrial negotiations that involved the prosecutor offering to forego seeking the death penalty in this case in exchange for a guilty plea or a bench trial was an unconstitutional condition pursuant to United States v. Jackson. As this Court is well aware, habeas relief lies only in the wake of an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, a decision that is contrary to that authority, or an unreasonable determination of the facts.
And we've all read the briefs, and I just would like you to address first, why isn't Bordenkercher the relevant Supreme Court precedent?
I do believe that it is, Your Honor. And I think specifically because Bordenkercher discusses specifically prosecutorial discretion in engaging in pretrial negotiations. United States v. Jackson doesn't address this topic or these kinds of interactions at all, but rather addresses the operation of a federal statute.
Well, the time frame during which these discussions took place was what, over a 9-month period?
Your Honor, I believe it may have been 11 months, in fact, if I'm not mistaken.
So the various proposals that were made during that time frame, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And specifically, this case is a good illustration of the material differences between pretrial negotiations and the kind of operation indiscriminately or categorically of a federal statute, as was discussed in Jackson. And in this case, there were a number of reasons why a bench trial would have been advantageous to both the state and the defendant. And in fact, Mr. Corcoran's materials filed in his post-conviction proceedings and his direct appeal are replete with his lawyer's statements suggesting that they wished that Mr. Corcoran would have chosen to accept one of those offers.
But I guess what I'm troubled by is what makes this different from any other plea? You know, how is the jury waiver alone different from entering a guilty plea if by entering the plea the defendant also waives his jury rights?
Your Honor, I don't think that there's any material difference for these purposes. And that is why Bordenkercher is the controlling case. And Bordenkercher clearly states that offering this kind of consideration in exchange for a guilty plea is constitutionally acceptable. Here, part of Corcoran's position is that guilt and innocence was still at issue here. So that's part of the reason why it was somewhat coercive to discuss this as a consideration for the acceptance of a bench trial. And in response to that, I'd simply point out to the court that it was clear that the defense had no evidence to present at the guilt and innocence phase of the proceeding. There was a videotaped confession. There was physical evidence which matched Corcoran's own recitation of how these murders occurred. He didn't have an insanity defense. He'd been found competent by 2 out of 3 of the court-appointed doctors that examined him. And his lawyers had explained to him that they believed that had he gone, or if he would go to trial, a jury trial, that a jury would recommend death.
So what was the actual harm to Corcoran by this offer?
There was none, Your Honor. And in fact, it was construed by his lawyers and characterized by his lawyers as a generous offer. Accordingly, there's just no relationship between the kind of unconstitutional condition that was found in the federal kidnapping statute by the United States Supreme Court in the Jackson case and pretrial negotiations here. Judge Sharp extrapolated from that holding with regard to some hypotheticals that he entertained in his opinion and granted relief on that theory when, in fact, Jackson is not at all clearly established federal law. And just a few more points on this issue, Your Honor. There are a number of reasons why a bench trial in this case was something that would have been beneficial to the administration of justice, to the state, and to the defendant. One of which is it offered Corcoran an opportunity to actually have an opportunity for acquittal, even though the circumstances would have made that a slim prospect, without risking the death penalty. He would have already had the assurance that the maximum punishment sought would have been life without parole.
Do I recall it in Indiana that when the jury returns a death penalty, it's optional with the judge as to whether he gives it or is he compelled to give it?
At that time, Your Honor,
Yeah. It
was the judge's ultimate decision
ultimate decision of the judge, so that the jury trial at best is a recommendation. Many of the judges in Indiana take the position that when a jury returns a guilty, they feel fairly duty-bound to do it.
It's now mandatory by law, Your Honor.
In the days when this was going on, were there judges that had that position?
I don't know specifically, Your Honor, but I believe that is probably true.
There are some cases in Illinois which refer to that at about the same period of time when it was optional with the judge after them. But they could not give it without the jury verdict, but some of them felt duty-bound once there was a jury. They could give it on a bench trial, but they couldn't give it on a jury trial.
And I am sure, Your Honor, that there were trial court judges in Indiana at that time that did feel, at least practically, bound by the jury's recommendation, but not legally. I think that any trial court judge would have known that they were not legally required to do that.
Defendant's attorneys ever suggest a reason why he rejected the offer?
There is no good reason on the record, except that Corcoran simply said, I feel like I should try this before a jury. I feel like I want a jury's verdict. So really, we are left to speculate as to why Corcoran insisted upon that.
I should have reserved the question for your opponent, not for you anyway.
And let me ask you this. Do you think, and I understand you think Borden-Kircher applies, but do you think there should be any limits on the prosecutor's abilities to bargain away constitutional rights?
I think the limit, Your Honor, is that they be knowing and voluntary and intelligently made, just as they would be if the entire bundle, as it were relinquished in giving a guilty plea. So, for instance, if Mr. Corcoran had agreed to the waiver of the jury trial in this case and submitted the case to the bench, of course he would be required to do that knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and he could challenge that, of course, if there was some question about that. But as long, Borden-Kircher explicitly states that as long as the defendant has the opportunity to reject or accept the offer, that there's no coercion and that there's no unnecessary or undue burdening of a constitutional right by making these kinds of offers to dispose of a case.
How many peremptory challenges were accorded each side in the capital case in those days? If you don't know, that's an easy one.
I don't know, Your Honor.
You don't have to know. Your memory doesn't extend that far.
I could at best offer you a ballpark figure, which may be inaccurate. So,
and let me just ask you more on this, how far you think it should go. So do you think it would be okay for a prosecutor to offer to take the death penalty off the table if the defendant agreed to waive the right to an attorney or his Fifth Amendment right?
Your Honor, the Fifth Amendment right, depending on how that was posed, I think is something that could be done. Again, the...
So you think that would be okay
Amendment.
In the court?
She's talking, I think,
yeah,
the Sixth Amendment. Right to a trial with a lawyer, see?
Yeah, correct. I'm talking about the Sixth Amendment right to a lawyer and the Fifth Amendment right. If he agreed to give up, could he bargain that away? In other words, could the prosecutor say, you know, I'll take the death penalty off the table if you agree to waive your right to a lawyer? Let's just take it one by one.
You'll fire the guy you've got.
You know, Your Honor, I've considered that question because I think that is the most interesting hypothetical that kind of boils up to the surface from this whole thought process. And I would, candidly, I think that it would be very difficult for the state to be able to assert a legitimate goal in asking him to go forward without an attorney in exchange for consideration.
He'd probably get disbarred for raising the question, so that's to take care of the problem.
I think in almost every circumstance you can assume that having counsel present is beneficial to the court, it's beneficial to the defendant, it's beneficial to the state. So it's difficult for me to foresee circumstances that would make that a legitimate goal that wasn't needlessly attempting to burden the invocation of the right. But I also do believe, bottom line, that because the defendant has every opportunity and every freedom to decline that and would, then well, this would never become an issue.
The defendant has a right to fire his lawyer and proceed pro se if he wants.
He may.
And you know what? He does it now. They do it now.
And for him to do that, though, Your Honor, in response to a prosecutor's entreaty,
that's
would
a different
be,
matter
would be,
altogether.
Yes, not a very not a very pretty picture, if you will.
Usually the prosecutor's fighting the other way, asking the court not to let him do it.
Yeah, interestingly, in this case, Mr. Corcoran attempted to assert his right to represent himself at trial at one point. So none of these things ultimately are issues. As we know, that Mr. Corcoran went forward with counsel and tried his case to a jury.
So what about his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent if he was told, you know, we'll take the death penalty off the table if you give up your Fifth Amendment right?
I think that that's something that could be done, Your Honor. If the defendant wished to have, say, for instance, an inculpatory statement that was given but that was perhaps done without the benefit of a Miranda warning. All the parties were aware of the salient and relevant facts and knew that this would be inadmissible. There could be an offer and an acceptance of an offer for this kind of consideration to allow it to be admitted without objection.
How about if you'll testify at a joint trial, you'll testify and say that your co-defendant committed the crime as well. Could you do that legitimately?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you?
If you said to a defendant who is charged with murder that I will not ask the death penalty, if you will take the stand voluntarily and testify that you committed the crime and so did your co-defendant, or that you didn't and your co-defendant did.
Absent any brutal problems, Your Honor, I think that that would also be acceptable.
Yep.
Why don't you move to your second issue?
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. The second issue is Mr. Corcoran's issue on cross-appeal, and he is challenging the Indiana Post-Conviction Court's finding that he was competent to waive post-conviction review.
There we go.
Corcoran's position on this issue is reducible to two incorrect positions, or two incorrect premises, probably more accurately. The first is that a court, as a finder of fact in determining competence, may not disagree with experts about the motivation for a waiver and whether or not it's based on real-world considerations. The second is that to the extent that the court could agree with the expert's conclusions, this agreement would have to be based on contrary expert testimony. Neither of these contentions has support in federal law, And the post-conviction court properly concluded that Mr. Corcoran was competent to waive his post-conviction review. There are some facial similarities between what happened in this case and the case that this court decided in St. Pierre v. Cowan. However, the difference is we don't have an endless and repeated assertion of a right and then a contrary attempt to waive it. We have what Mr. Corcoran essentially acquiesced in the pursuit of appellate and post-conviction remedies on a couple of occasions in this case. There's nothing in the record that shows an active or affirmative authorization or intent by Mr. Corcoran to go forward.
Well, is there any reported case where three unrebutted experts have found that a defendant is incompetent for purposes of waiving the appeal, but the court found that he was competent? You know, with no contrary testimony?
I'm not familiar with one off the top of my head, Your Honor, but I can say that it's not uncommon in Indiana cases for there to be a preponderance, consensus, or even almost unanimity of expert testimony presented by a capital post-conviction petitioner in support of a mental state that's attempted to be proved factually in a post-conviction court, and the post-conviction court has declined to find it. And I think that this is because the legal question of competence ultimately resides with the court as the trier of fact. And here, what we have are three doctors at post-conviction who, with near unanimity or with at best minor disagreements or differing accounts, acknowledge the fact that Mr. Corcoran is able to understand the nature of the proceedings he's engaged in. He's familiar with and exhibits a deep understanding of the history of the proceedings. He knows what the post-conviction petition is for. And he clearly knew the consequences of waiving the petition. This is in no way comparable. Recently, this court handed down a decision from the Southern District in Indiana in the Holmes case, which had to do with competency to pursue federal habeas review in a capital case. And the court remanded that for more proceedings because Judge McKinney, while finding him competent to pursue habeas, relied on the statements of the petitioner to the exclusion of opinions offered by the doctor. The court found that that was otherwise acceptable, except that it was concerned about certain long diatribes and statements made by Holmes in the context of his conversation with the district court that the district court, this court concluded, didn't give enough consideration to in determining whether he was competent.
One of Corcoran's delusions was the belief that the prison guards were torturing him with sound waves. Isn't the contention that he wants to die in order to escape these delusions the same as him saying that he wants to end his appeals in order to escape the paranoid delusions?
Your Honor, he explicitly stated in open court, after hearing all of the testimony of the post-conviction doctors, that was not the reason why he wanted to waive his appeal, or why he wanted to waive his post-conviction review.
But shouldn't we focus on whether or not he made a rational choice in light of what the expert testimony was? Because I understand there was evidence that he appreciated his position, that he was being tried for capital murder. But didn't the expert testimony show he didn't have the ability to make a rational choice as required under Rees?
That was their opinion. And the post-conviction court did not credit that opinion, as was the post-conviction court's prerogative as the finder of fact.
But doesn't Rees require both a showing of the ability to appreciate one's position and the ability to make a rational choice?
It does. And I think that Dusky, and I think it's Godinez is the United States Supreme Court case that talked about both the Dusky standard and the Rees standard and that there wasn't really a material difference between the two with regard to requiring an ability to be rational in making the decision. And here, the doctors opined that Corcoran wanted to waive his appeals so that he could die and escape his delusions. The post-conviction court had had a long history of observing Mr. Corcoran, having presided over his trial court proceedings and post-conviction proceedings, and also had a very cogent and articulate conversation with Mr. Corcoran in the post-conviction court, and had the post-conviction doctors that were obtained by Corcoran for the competency determination opined that he had an understanding and an ability to communicate and an ability to remember and discuss facts relevant to legal claims. Now, the ultimate decision of the experts that he was attempting to end his life to escape his delusions is undercut by a number of things. I think that Corcoran's ability to cogently answer questions and understand what's going on around him is one of those things.
But when we look at how Reese has been applied, for example, when you look at the Fifth Circuit case, Rumbacher has a three-part test. I mean, that's how they looked at the Reese standard. And they say that the third part of the test is the person suffering from a mental disease or defect which does not prevent him from understanding his legal positions and the options available to him. Does that disease or defect prevent him from making a rational choice among his options? So there's a distinction that's drawn about that rational choice.
There is, Your Honor, and if I can be clear about something, and I don't mean to belabor it, I just want to be clear on the state's position. The state's position is that the Indiana Supreme Court conducted a constitutionally proper review of the examination and determination that Mr. Corcoran was competent. As we know, states are not required to provide post-conviction relief. Given that Indiana does so, it is, of course, required to afford due process and constitutional protections as necessary for the petitioner to utilize this stage of review. We would assert that the use of the Reese and Dusky standards to review the post-conviction court's decision and its evaluation comports with all of those constitutional requirements and places the finding beyond federal habeas review. But I am aware of the fact that pre-amendments to the federal habeas statutes that this court has reviewed such claims, and we would simply submit in accord with that, that what the courts did here meets constitutional muster. With regard to the rationality requirement that you've asked me about, Judge Williams, here, interestingly, the post-conviction doctors that testified on Corcoran's behalf didn't testify or find that there were significant or new origins of these problems. Rather, they testified in terms of him having had these over a long-standing period of time.
But then they say they had aggravated and they had grown with time, gotten more severe with time.
Yes, I do think that there was some testimony to that effect. But the entire evaluation was based on them identifying this psychosis and this delusional state at a long time past, and they referenced the evaluations and the findings of the doctors that were consulted for trial to this end. And I just think it's interesting to note, and I think it's one of the things that a post-conviction court is correct and allowed to consider, is the fact that these lawyers that represented Mr. Corcoran at state post-conviction, the same lawyers that went out and obtained these experts to testify at this competency hearing, these experts who found that he has long been delusional and that consulted the trial court findings and the trial court evaluations in the context of their own evaluations, also raised in the petition that this whole waiver and competency hearing pertained to, a claim that Mr. Corcoran had been unconstitutionally denied his right to self-representation at trial. So I think it's just an example of how when a battle of the experts is required to determine competency, and a fact finder is not allowed discretion to weigh and credit the facts for themselves, it's just results in a multiplicity of gamesmanship in post-judgment capital litigation that's already considerable to make it an understatement.
I take it then that there isn't a procedure, a statutory procedure for court-appointed experts in this situation? Or is there, and it just wasn't used in this case?
There is a statutory procedure for appointing experts to determine competency for trial, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I know I've been involved in post-conviction proceedings where that was modified and used. But in this case, I believe...
You didn't ask for it? And
counsel for the petitioner will correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe that... In this case, counsel for the petitioner simply asked for appointments of the doctors that they intended to present testimony from, and the court granted it.
They had already designated which doctors he wanted? Is that you?
These doctors were of the public defender's choosing. Yes, Your Honor.
Not the court's?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, the court appointed them at the behest of the public defender.
It wasn't a random appointment by the court?
No.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. We request that you reverse the district court's grant of relief.
Mr. Comp?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The appellant fails to recognize the critical distinction between the usual plea bargaining or guilty plea context and what occurred in this case. An essential component of a plea bargain or a guilty plea is an admission of guilt.
Or in the Alford case, it says you don't have to admit guilt but plead guilty.
That
was to avoid the death penalty, too, if you remember.
But it's a different circumstance where, in this circumstance, the
Alford penalty was precisely the reason for the Alford decision was precisely because if he continued to plead not guilty and the jury found him guilty, he would be sentenced to hang, and that would be the end of that. To avoid that, he said he would enter a plea of guilty, although he didn't kill anybody. That's his statement. And the Supreme Court of the United States said he had that prerogative. He could plead guilty even though he didn't follow the rule which required slaying a factual predicate for the plea.
But that's
still good law, by the way.
But Jackson is also still good law.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying it is not that you're bargaining to avoid the death penalty, because that's precisely what Alfred was doing, only he refused to plead guilty, and they said you could do it anyway.
And you can...
Even after the jury had found him guilty and sentenced him to death, by the way. So.
But in this circumstance, the penalty you're attaching for your assertion of your right to jury is we're going to go for death. You know, we wouldn't be...
But they're not guaranteed that the jury's going to rush in with death. They said we won't ask the jury to return the death penalty, au contraire, if you waive a jury. But if you keep a jury... We'll let them determine whether or not you die.
But we're going to pursue that. But we're not interested.
In control of whether or not the jury returns the finding of guilty plus the death penalty. That's a jury problem. And if you want a jury, they say take the whole program. Take all of it or not.
But in this case, you cannot, and what the Supreme Court says in Jackson is you cannot penalize the assertion of your right to jury. You cannot
Absolutely.
Contingent.
You cannot.
And that's what, in this case, this
it's
is what
a
occurred.
It's not a penalty if the judge, if the lawyer says, I won't ask for the death penalty if you waive a jury. He can say, I won't ask for the death penalty if you plead guilty, too. And that's the ultimate in giving up. You give up everything, your right to confront witnesses, your right to call witnesses, your right to anything, trial by jury, trial by the bench. Just give up everything. And they can ask for that.
But the central component of that is the admission of guilt. And when you make that admission of guilt, you're...
But that's giving up a jury right to have the jury find you guilty. Even if you are guilty, you can say, nope, later to find them. Maybe one of them will lose their mind.
Well, and again, I think that's a different question, though. Well, I mean, then we're getting into whether it's a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver.
Suggest that you can't piecemeal a request in plea bargaining, you can say give up this, give up that, is just defying in the face of all the plea bargaining that's been going on in the United States since we had plea bargaining.
But the plea bargaining...
At least in Santabella.
But I respectfully disagree.
I don't ask for unanimity opinion. I've never been able to get it anyway.
But in Jackson, in this case, the district court appropriately found that the offer made by the prosecutor exceeded what is the boundaries of what is acceptable. And what this offer boils down to, and they had an appropriate offer. They said if you make an admission of guilt, all your bundled rights will go away, and you can avoid the death penalty. And the problem that the district court had, and rightly had, was with the second offer, which dealt with, we'll get rid of your right to a jury trial, and then, you know, we'll take death off the table. Because the difference is, in Indiana, they can take death off the table. They don't file the notice of death, and then the death's not an option.
Well, you see, he wanted a jury trial. He was entitled to a jury trial. He got a jury trial.
But they penalized his assertion of the jury trial.
Now, that's where you and I disagree. The jury bringing in a verdict that is perfectly appropriate under Indiana law is not penalizing him.
But they penalized the state.
They said they wouldn't give him a break. There's a difference between penalizing and not giving him a break.
The right to jury shouldn't hinge on whether you get the death penalty and vice versa. The death penalty shouldn't hinge on whether you assert the right to the jury. And that's precisely what the state did illegally in this context. They hinged the death penalty on the assertion of his right to jury.
What case do you think of where the Supreme Court of the United States has said that you cannot make that offer?
United States versus Jackson.
Oh.
That's not a plea bargaining case, though. That was an evaluation of the operation of a statute, and Bordenkercher stands for the proposition that the quid pro quos that are exchanged in connection with plea bargaining don't constitute a penalty. If it did, then Bordenkercher would have come out differently, right?
Not necessarily so, because Bordenkercher, again, the central focus of Bordenkercher was the admission of guilt. And that's where, when they made the offer to him, it was if you plead guilty to this, this will avoid all these other consequences. So you bundled all your rights away, and he said, no, I'm not going to accept that bargain. And then he faced the consequences for turning down that bargain. And Bordenkercher itself indicated that if you punish someone for doing what the law allows them to do or assert, violates due process. Bordenkercher itself recognized that and distinguished itself from Jackson.
And see, the problem I have is, what is the actual harm to Corcoran by this offer? I mean, he would have still, and wouldn't he still have exercised his right to a jury trial if the offer hadn't been made? I mean, that's putting it a little differently, a little slightly different twist than the questions Judge Bauer asked.
I think in the circumstance and in the penalty that comes out from Jackson, and I think it appropriately found by the district court, is we shouldn't encourage, and it's sort of what this court was in questioning the attorney general. I mean, this is a slippery slope that can start. I mean, it's an actual slippery slope.
Well, if the court adopts your position, wouldn't this extend Jackson to the plea bargaining process and would discourage prosecutors from extending plea offers?
Absolutely not. Because
Why not?
Because a plea offer is an admission of guilt. Didn't ask for an admission of guilt.
Wouldn't the prosecutor be reluctant to make any sort of an offer once he knows that if he makes the offer, all is lost? He's stuck with it, whether the guy accepts it or doesn't.
Absolutely not. Because, again, the central component of a plea bargaining, and this is what Bordenkercher says, Brady versus United States says, Corbett versus New Jersey says.
Did you give up certain rights as a defendant in exchange for something that you want? That is right. For me to say I won't ask for the death penalty.
But what's on the table, well, none of those cases were death penalty cases, and Corbett itself distinguished in the Corbett opinion, noted that this is not a death penalty case and cited Gregg versus Georgia. So we're talking about the protections of in a death penalty case versus all those cases didn't deal with the death penalty. But what those cases say, the central component of all those cases is the admission of guilt. And that's when you get your bundled rights are taken away from you. And you know, obviously there are a lot of guilty plea cases where that could probably come before this court on a daily basis about whether or not the guilty plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, et cetera. That's a different issue. And we're not challenging any either the federal government's or the state of Indiana's ability to engage in the plea bargaining process. But a component of that plea bargaining process cannot punish an individual if they refuse to play by the state's rules. Some of the examples you gave could happen. I mean, it's an actual real slippery slope.
So the parties can negotiate over a guilty plea but nothing else, apparently?
The negotiating process, I think, is a part of the everyday courtroom, but you can't put as a condition in a death penalty case, you can't condition the waiver of a constitutional right.
Unless it's a guilty plea.
Unless it's an admission of guilt. For instance, let's say, for example, instead of going to the right to counsel, let's say we're in a county that they don't like a certain attorney because his fee vouchers are higher.
That's Judge Williams' question. Can you say fire the lawyer?
Well, but can the prosecutor say take away your counsel of choice? Let us choose who your attorney is. So you still get your right to counsel, but you know we're going to choose who it is, and that's the real and actual slippery slope we start going down. I mean there aren't a lot of these cases. This simply isn't happening because it's taboo. You don't hinge the death penalty on the waiver of a constitutional right. And
it wasn't that they gave him the death penalty. They said that we will not ask the jury to return. You think control of the death penalty is entirely in the hands of the prosecution, but it is not. It is in the hands both of the judge and the jury, mostly the jury.
But
and
they...
The judge secondarily.
But if the state made the decision that the death penalty wasn't appropriate for a bench trial, then it should... Then that's those same policies and the same reasons behind that.
How many peremptory challenges did Indiana have for a death penalty case in those days? Illinois at the same time had 20 aside for it. So it would take as much as a week and a half to pick a jury in a death penalty case.
I'm not trying to avoid the court's question. I think it might have been 8 or 12. I'm not sure.
Like your opponent.
I know that the voir dire...
You're not of the age group where you'd remember
it. The voir dire in this case was in excess of 1,000 pages. So I would imagine that would mean that the number of peremptories that was available was quite high. And again, it's this admission of guilt that's central to the plea, and that's not what they're asking for. And that's really where the error is. It's penalizing his assertion of his constitutional rights. And saying, we don't think, and again, you know, listen to what their offer is. We don't think the death is appropriate here if we go to a bench trial, but if you go for a jury, we're going to try to execute you.
But I'm not sure that's the appropriate construction. It's an offer of leniency in exchange for waiving
the
jury
there,
and trying the case to the bench. It's not we don't think it's appropriate as a penalty. It's an offer to forego it in exchange for something that was of value to the state, that is, a bench trial instead of a jury trial.
But if death was appropriate for a bench trial, then there's really no difference than it being appropriate for a jury trial. And what they're trying to do, though, is chill his exercise of the constitutional right. And they're trying to trade that leniency.
Well, you can say that about requiring a plea of guilty before you set it to one side. They're trying to get him to waive his constitutional rights.
But he's making the admission of guilt. There's, you know, all his rights are bundled.
If what he did, as opposed to what he said, is the important thing, what difference does it make? They decided that what he did would be perfectly appropriate for less than the death penalty if he admits he did it. What's the difference? They can prove it, and you know it. And so did he.
But still, when
philosophically, what is the difference?
And I hope I understand your question correctly.
That the prosecution has determined that they justice has not demanded he get the death penalty. That's what they've determined when they say they're willing to set aside the death penalty if he pleads guilty.
Okay.
And what's the difference in having that philosophic attitude and saying, nor will we ask for the death penalty if you waive a jury, because we'll go along with you as far as you could put on whatever evidence you want. You want to put on evidence, put it on before His Honor.
The difference is, pardon me.
There's where I fail to find one.
The difference is that they're placing that bargain. And again, and that's...
But your statement was that they had already made the decision that it was not necessary for justice to be served for him to be executed. They made that decision when they say, if you want to plead guilty, we won't ask for it.
I think the difference is, though, and maybe I overstated, and I'm certainly can't ascribe what the intent was of the prosecutor, know what exactly was in his or her head. But the point I was trying to make is the threat here was real and tangible, and it's the only thing in the record, as noted by the district court, the only basis for that second offer was jury trial, wait for jury trial, and we'll take death off the table. There was no other consideration that was involved in that offer. And that the problem is with that, and what Jackson says, is that when you make contingent the waiver of a constitutional right with the threat of the death penalty, then there are problems with that. And
you want to get to the other half of your argument?
Yes. Well, on a cross appeal, we're raising that the state court's finding on competency to waive post conviction is rebutted by clear and convincing evidence in the record. And we satisfy 2254E1, the finding that he was competent to waive. And the basis of that is the opinions of three experts who all opine that he suffers from paranoid schizophrenia, all describe the delusions which he suffers from, and indicated that it's because of these delusions that he is making his decision to stop his post-conviction proceedings.
So is it your position that when Corcoran said, I would rather die, that's the same as saying, I don't want any more appeals? That's really your bottom line, isn't it?
That seems to be what he's saying at that time. I mean, there's been some vacillation. Sometimes he'll sign things saying, I want to go on. For instance, in the district court, he signed the indigency affidavit and allowed us to proceed initially and then file paperwork afterwards. Yes.
Well, did the Indiana Supreme Court's decision articulate any reason for finding these to be different? That is, those statements.
Well, I think what they accepted those statements, but we, again, and our contention is that they didn't do what this court when the Attorney General was up here was questioning the court about, was they didn't go past and. He offered a rational basis, what appears on its face to be a rational basis, but they didn't look past that snapshot to look at what was the reason what was behind that decision. And all the experts agree that the basis of his decision is to end his agony.
Except he said that wasn't it.
Pardon me?
He told the court that wasn't true.
And
the judge was entitled to accept that.
I think, though, when in the face of all these experts, just taking out that little snapshot, and we think our position is analogous to what this court found in St. Pierre, that you have to look not just at those. And I mean, if you look at the supplemental record we filed, that his colloquy with the court goes on for five pages. The four and a half pages of that is yes and no questions, leading questions, and the whole finding of competency boils down to seven lines that he gave at the end of the hearing, and then the court cuts off questioning. There's no follow-up questions after that point. And our contention is, after 80-plus pages from three experts describing the mental illness, reports from the trial level documenting the onset of the paranoid schizophrenia and the delusions that are in place, that it's not just enough to look at that snapshot. And it's important, and I think this is where there's a real weakness in what the state court did. It's not enough that he offered a rational basis and he understands that it'll be executed. That's more like a Ford test. You know, the Reese test requires him to have the capacity to appreciate his legal position and the ability to make a rational decision, or whether he suffers from a mental disease, disorder, or defect which may substantially impair. And they did not faithfully apply that standard in the face of these three experts, all saying paranoid schizophrenia, all saying delusional, saying he wants to end his appeals and end the agony that he suffers from.
Do you think there could ever be a time or where a state court would be justified in finding that a defendant is competent, even when the only expert testimony is to the contrary?
We're not asking for that extreme of a position. I think if there is adequate, if there is cross-undermining the bases for the decisions of what the doctors are and the degree of symptomology, then I think there could be a circumstance where that could occur. But that's not this case. In this case, everybody agrees. The courts, the experts all agree the extent of his mental illness. And our contention is that given the clear and convincing evidence from these three experts that's uncontradicted and never been challenged by the state, that looking at that seven-line snapshot is not enough and was not enough, and that we have satisfied 2254E1 and that the state court's competency finding was not adequate.
Now, at the time of the hearing, he was medicated, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And weren't his delusions under control when he was medicated?
It's not clear. He certainly wasn't outward comporting himself in the courtroom in a way that disrupted proceedings, but there's testimony from, I believe, Dr. Kaplan that noted that he was being medicated for his paranoid schizophrenia and that the medication was not stopping the delusions and did not impact the delusions that he was in pain from. And that's one of the bases of this Indiana State Supreme Court decision, that, well, he's being medicated. And that was one of the three reasons that they offered for affirming the trial court's finding of his competency to waive, and it's not supported by the record. The only expert testimony is that prison corrections recognizes that he's a paranoid schizophrenic, that he's receiving medication for that and treatment for that, but the medication is not stopping those delusions. And I believe that's Dr. Kaplan that provided that testimony. The other bases that the Indiana Supreme Court offered, the main basis was that the Indiana Supreme Court found him competent and affirmed the post-conviction trial court on the basis that there was no expert testimony that he was waiving because of his mental illness. And all three experts indicated that he was, in fact, waiving because of the agony that he suffered. And I think Dr. Parker described it, Mr. Corcoran, indicating that it would be a blessed relief if he could end this agony from the mental illness. So the bases that the Indiana Supreme Court relied on in rejecting the expert testimony is just not well-founded. I would ask this court to look at Smith versus Armantrout, which was cited by both the appellant and ourselves, and that's a critical component. And Smith, they weren't... It's sort of the inverse of this case. We weren't relying... It goes back to the rational questions that this, whether or not it had to be rational, and whether you had to look past that. And the court said, it's not enough that you give a rational reason, like spending the rest of my life in jail would be torture itself, and that's why I want to waive. The person, just because they come up with a rational reason, it's not enough. That has to be, in fact, the real reason that they're waiving. They can't just parrot something they've heard that's rational and that be the basis of a waiver. You have to examine what the basis is and determine whether or not that is their real reason or whether or not there's a true reason underneath that. And we believe the overwhelming weight of this record provides the real reason, and that's just to end his agony. There are no further questions?
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How much time does he have?
3.5.
Mr. Martin, why don't you begin on that last point in terms of what was in the record and the fact that the three experts testified and there were only a few pages relating to Mr. Corcoran and his responses, and that the court didn't really look at the full context of his condition in making the finding about his competence.
Oh, I think the court did look at the whole context of the evidence. Naturally, Your Honor, there are pages and pages and pages of expert testimony, as expert psychiatric testimony typically does take up a large portion of the record. And Mr. Kampf is correct that the interaction with Mr. Corcoran was fairly brief, but it was also fairly articulate, and he did thoroughly explain his reason for wanting to waive his appeals. And the thing about this notion that the expert's ultimate opinion about his motivation for wanting to waive should be accepted is, again, it's based on this notion that there should be competing expert testimony. If the state is required to conduct a battle of the experts in all such circumstances, then I'm certain that it can be done. I don't think it's necessarily going to make for a clearer or more reliable determination of competency. This man killed four people, one of which was his brother, and the other was his sister's fiancé. He said that he thought that this was a just punishment. There's not evidence in the record to suggest that he felt guilty or that he felt that in order for things to be made right, that he had to accept his execution. But that is certainly inferable from the facts in the case. And there's nothing irrational about that. And to the extent that Dr. Kaplan is relied upon to offer the ultimate conclusion about why he's waiving his appeals, Dr. Kaplan alluded to a number of things that any layperson might think out loud about that is not particularly within the province of a psychiatric expert, one of which was Corcoran's understandings and his beliefs about his Christian teachings. Corcoran had expressed his belief that he would go to heaven if he perished through execution, and that he was ready to do that. And Dr. Kaplan found that this was irrational and had some conflicting beliefs of his own about what the Christian faith teaches about suicide and whether one can go to heaven. This is not helpful psychiatric testimony, and it kind of belies the conclusion or the results-driven testimony above and beyond the doctor's ability to talk about his thought processes. Might I have one more thing, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
Dr. Parker, for example, admitted that Mr. Corcoran's thinking processes were organized, that he exhibited organized thought. Now, I know that he went on to say that he believed Mr. Corcoran to be schizophrenic and delusional, but typically speaking, organized thought is the very antithesis of schizophrenia. And I'm not a doctor and don't purport to offer a competing opinion, but I mean, I think these are the kind of things that a post-conviction court can take a hold of and consider and make a credibility determination on. And Justice Rucker, in his dissenting opinion on state Supreme Court review, made note of the fact, he said he believed the experts should have been given credence. And I think credence is the operative word. The post-conviction court did not give them credence. It made a credibility decision, and that's what a trier of fact has to do in these cases.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both sides for their very fine argument. You were appointed, and we thank you very much for taking this appointment and for all the diligence
and
you've
for
shown.
Doing such a splendid job,
right.
Both the brief writing and the argument.
Excellent job. Court will stand in recess till tomorrow at 9:30.